Hello, and welcome to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Elaine, a longtime sci-fi fantasy fan, reading Frank Herbert's classic science fiction Dune Saga for the very first time. I'm joined by my co-host Alex, who is tackling his first reread. Join our chapter-by-chapter deep dive into the series, as I make wildly incorrect predictions, Alex tries not to give anything away, and together, we learn to walk without rhythm.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Pod Emperor of Dune. I'm Alex here, as always, with Elaine.
Hey, everyone.
So today we're diving into chapters 15 through 17 of Dune Messiah. So without further ado, you want me to get started with our first epigraph?
Sounds good.
All right, so I'll have to put my vindictive preacher voice on for this one, because this one is super preachy. It's from the Iyam el-Din, Book of Judgment. The audacious nature of Muad'Dib's actions may be seen in the fact that he knew from the beginning whither he was bound, yet not once did he step aside from that path. He put it clearly when he said, "I tell you that I come now to my time of testing when it will be shown that I am the ultimate servant." Thus he weaves all into one, that both friend and foe may worship him. It is for this reason and this reason only that his apostles prayed, "Lord, save us from the other paths which Muad'Dib covered with the waters of his life." Those other paths may be imagined only with the deepest revulsion.
Yeah, definitely preachy. I mean, when you got a wither thrown in there.
Yeah, true. I feel like whenever you see he all over the place with the capital H, it's going to be preachy, so.
Yeah, you typically don't tend to capitalize pronouns unless you're talking about some sort of god figure. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this seems to be a sort of history, I guess, although with overtly religious overtones, describing Paul's choices as always being the lesser of possible evils, in which he chose paths that were harmful or unfavorable to himself and his own happiness and well-being, even when he knew these bad things were coming, in order to avert some greater and more horrible future.
Right, which is kind of what we get from Paul's thoughts as well, that that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to avoid worse futures by taking paths that may not be great for him, but paths that he finds to be necessary.
Yeah, what I find interesting is that this is a little bit related to this chapter, but I actually think it's a better thematic fit for the third chapter, in which Paul does a lot of thinking about that exact thing of, I know this path that I'm going down, and it's not good, but I have to do it anyway, even though I'm kind of looking for a way out, but I also am just going along with things and letting them play out as I know they will. So, I don't know. I thought it would have fit better with the third chapter, but it's not exactly an uncommon theme in terms of what we get from Paul's thoughts. It's just here it's externalized in some sort of very religious, preachy history. The Book of Judgment.
Hey, it's still better than Thirsty Worm songs, though.
Agreed. Or impenetrable philosophical meanderings, because this at least is pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it's preachy, but you get the point of it.
Exactly.
Pretty easily.
All right, so shall we move into the chapter itself?
Sure, let's do it.
All right, so this chapter is really interesting because we now begin to see the conspiracy's plan move forward. So Cytale has taken on the appearance of Othaim's daughter, Lykna, who, of course, we know to be dead in the desert. The disguise fools Chaney, however, who recognizes Lykna's face, name, and family. Upon hearing that this girl is apparently the child of a member of Paul's Fedaiken, his head of security, a man called Banerjee, arranges for Cytale Lykna to be brought to Paul directly to give him some sort of message she claims to be carrying from Othaim. She is screened and searched, but then is brought to Paul's office by Banerjee. We learn that Banerjee is not one of Paul's original men, but has worked his way up through the ranks through intelligence and loyalty. And we learn that he apparently originates from the smugglers. He is described as perhaps somewhat sociopathic, able to watch horrors without blinking, and Paul knows that he would strangle the girl in front of him without hesitation if ordered to do so.
Good guy to have around, I guess.
Certainly practical. We can tell from Paul's thoughts that he knows from the get-go that this girl is an imposter. So, Chaney may have been fooled, but Paul is not. Although, this is likely because he already knows that she's an imposter, so if he wasn't expecting this, he might have been fooled.
What do you mean?
So, I think he and Aaliyah had figured out, or he, Aaliyah, and Hate maybe had figured out what to be looking for, that a face dancer was going to be impersonating someone.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You mean, like, also having the knowledge of, like, the girl missing in the desert and all that.
Yeah, I think in the background you're supposed to infer that they've figured out that this girl is an imposter ahead of time, or they are at least on the lookout for someone to be an imposter, whereas if they weren't expecting that, he may have been fooled by this.
Gotcha. Yep, I'm with you now. Makes sense.
And also, it's not exactly clear how he knows from his thoughts, but we also do get a hint that he got some sort of inkling from his visions as well that something was going to be off about this, even if Cytale Lichna is sort of clouded specifically.
Yeah, he also does note a bunch of subtleties in her appearance that are kind of off from the way she'd normally be.
Although he does note that the imposter is nearly perfect, completely in character, from appearance to behavior to clothes, to the tiniest hint of Samuda addiction at the corners of her eyes. So, potentially, there's some sort of color indication or something.
Mm-hmm. Almost like a jaundice type thing.
Yeah. Cytale Lichna, not realizing that she's already found out, now has to speak to Paul and realizes that it is the most intense test she will ever have to face. She must fool the all-powerful and prescient Emperor, who knew this girl when she was a child in his siege. She can replicate the voice and the mannerisms with her face dancer abilities, but she must also avoid triggering any memories of Paul's that might reveal the ruse with some sort of subtle difference she's not able to pick up on.
Hey, remember that time back in Siege Tabor when such and such happened? Like, shit.
Yeah, it is interesting that the face dancers seem to be able to kind of preternaturally pick up a lot of their targets, mannerisms, and such, but not their memories, I guess. So I wonder exactly how they pick these things up. I can't imagine it's just from direct study.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it's some sort of other ability, but they don't seem to be able to pick up exact memories the same way. Although, I guess we don't really know.
Yeah.
Of course, we know that all of this doesn't matter since Paul already knows she's an imposter. So it's kind of funny to be reading Cytale Lichna's thoughts of like, oh, I've really got to make sure I get this right.
Yeah.
When you then switch to Paul's perspective and he's like, yeah, I know.
Got it all figured out.
So Cytale Lichna introduces herself as the daughter of Othium. Appraising the situation, Paul is not at all surprised that Chaney was taken in by the disguise and thinks that it is only really his Bene Gesserit training in combination with his prescience and, like, foreknowledge that allows him to see it.
Mm-hmm.
He notes that she is the tiniest bit too old, has the slightest bit too much voice control, holds her shoulders just a little less high than a Fremen would. However, he also notes the dedication to the role down to minor details of costuming, which he thinks indicates a sympathy with the victim, which seems in keeping with what we know about the face dancers and Cytale specifically.
Right.
That he seemed regretful of having to do these things that he does, but they're what he has to do, so he just kind of does it anyway. But he is inhabiting this role very fully, and Paul thinks that indicates sympathy.
He's a sympathetic killer.
I guess so. However, Paul doesn't let on that he knows something is up, and he formally welcomes her, allowing Cytale Lichna to slightly relax. She says that she brings a message, and thinks about how she must now guide Paul down the correct path, which is apparently that they will somehow cause Chaney's death in a way that no one else could possibly be involved, other than Paul, and somehow this deeply personal failure and tragedy, despite his apparent omnipotence, will drive Paul into the arms of the Tlaylaxu, to accept the Tlaylaxu alternative, as Cytale Lichna puts it. I don't know if this means that they'll give him a Chaney Gola and they want him to accept this, but I don't really know how that furthers their goals, and I'm not sure exactly what this means. It's not elaborated on at all.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow the loss of Chaney will force Paul to turn to the Tlaylaxu for something.
Okay.
Cytale Lichna speaks a code phrase of the Fedaiken, indicating to Paul that this is a real message from Othium, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Paul is struggling to remain calm. It seems that he can only see a very little bit of these events, as Cytale Lichna herself is shielded from his prescience due to Edric's influence. Paul does not know how to make it through these events, but he only knows the things he can't do, lest there be an even worse outcome. For example, he doesn't know exactly what he's supposed to do, but he does know that if he kills Cytale Lichna, this will lead to the future that must be avoided at all costs, so he's basically forbidden from doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Paul hopes to find a way through the darkness of the future to change events for the better, although I think, as I've said before, he doesn't have the greatest track record of actually changing the future. Paul asks for the message. Cytale Lichna looks at Banerjee, who has his hand on his knife, and challenges him that the innocent don't believe in evil, so basically kind of accusing him of being a bad guy for suspecting her, I guess. Despite himself, Paul is momentarily impressed, as this is apparently spot-on Lichna, and he briefly mourns for the real girl dead in the desert, but then tells himself he has no time for such emotions. Or any emotions, really. Cytale Lichna protests that she was instructed to deliver her message in secret, and when Banerjee asks why, she says it's because Othium wishes it. Paul says that he is a Fremen, and therefore his friend Banerjee can hear whatever it is Paul wants him to hear, so invoking some kind of Fremen tradition that one's trusted friends can be allowed to hear anything, I guess. Cytale Lichna hesitates, unsure whether this is actually a Fremen custom she's being tested on, but she ultimately says that the Emperor can have whatever rules he wants and relays the message, specifically that Othium wishes Paul to come to him and also to bring Chaney. Paul asks why Chaney must be involved, and Cytale Lichna invokes Fremen custom to have her there, being Paul's partner and a Sayadina on top of that, to attest to what Othium says. Paul recognizes that the conspiracy must really be working with Fremen to have such an accurate plan, because apparently this is what would be expected under these circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Paul asks what the topic will be, and Cytale Lichna tells him that Othium will speak of a plot against him among the Fremen. So quite a large grain of truth here. There is a plot among the Fremen, and based on what we get in the later chapters, it's very possible that Othium is genuinely trying to help Paul.
Right.
And is kind of just a pawn of the conspiracy. I mean, I think that's the likely case here. But they're all being manipulated by the conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
Paul sees that this moment fits with what he has seen coming and believes that he has no choice now but to play out the events he has seen. So, referencing the epigraph, essentially. Banerjee questions why Othium didn't come himself, and Cytale Lichna says that he is being watched and wouldn't have survived the journey. So the implication being that the traitors or conspirators would have killed him.
And as we learn later, he's not really in good condition to travel as it is.
No, he's not. He is dying. Banerjee then asks Cytale Lichna why she didn't just bring the information herself, and she says that they don't actually have it themselves, but it is locked inside a human distrans, which we've heard mentioned previously.
Mm-hmm.
Paul agrees to go to Othium, but refuses to take Chaney with him. When Cytale Lichna protests, he informs her that Chaney is pregnant, has been poisoned, and will therefore have a difficult birth, and cannot travel. Which seems reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Yep, totally.
Cytale Lichna is frustrated, not fully able to conceal this expression from her features, but thinks that even with this setback, the conspiracy can still succeed. Plus, even the Emperor is allowed his escape route by Tleilaxu custom. But overall, she thinks that Paul will meet the same fate as the Tleilaxu Kvisatz Haderach. Confronted with becoming the opposite of the creature he has molded himself into, he would rather die. Plus, there's also the influence of the Gola to consider, which also somehow fits into this plan. Cytale Lichna does try one more time, asking to petition Chaney herself, but Paul denies her. He says that she must accompany him instead, but she protests that it must be a Sayadina. Paul questions whether Cytale Lichna is Chaney's friend. Internally, she worries if Paul suspects her subterfuge, but comforts herself that Paul is just being typically cautious as any Fremen would be. Plus, the conspiracy knows the contraceptives were in play, so the Chaney story does fit. So she thinks that this is a reasonable hesitation for Paul to have and not an indication that he suspects anything. Although, of course, she's wrong about that.
Mm-hmm.
Cytale Lichna counters that she cannot go with Paul, as she was instructed by her father to seek asylum here and not return. Paul recognizes this as a clever play, because she can just plead Fremen duty to the orders of one's parents. Paul finally acquiesces and says he'll take Hara. Cytale Lichna says she doesn't know if she can trust Hara, and after some questioning, Paul decides that he will have Cytale Lichna's stepmother, Othium's second wife, serve in Chaney's place instead. I guess at this point they're just dropping the whole Sayadina thing and they just need a woman to witness this.
I guess so.
I feel like this went very quickly from your partner and a Sayadina to random messenger girl to random member of your household to member of the original household.
Yeah.
So I don't know why they specifically need a lady to do the witnessing, but whatever.
Yeah, well, I think originally it was a plan to get Chaney and Paul in the same room for some reason, but...
Or to get Paul to bring Chaney out into the dangerous streets where she could perhaps be assassinated or hurt or something.
Yeah.
At least that's my best guess, because it doesn't actually happen. We don't know what they were planning to do to Chaney, but it does sound like they were trying to have her killed.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously that aspect of the plan is no longer in play, so it does make you wonder what the point of getting Paul out to see Othium is. Clearly there's something else they're trying to do. It wasn't just about Chaney, but it did seem like that was an important piece of things, so it's interesting that they're so interested in getting Paul out to see Othium, even though the Chaney aspect is no longer relevant.
Right. So, maybe more to come on that.
I presume so. We don't really get an answer by the end of this couple of chapters. We do know that Paul picks up the Distrans, which contains information, but the relevance of that is not clear at this point. Perhaps it's just to sow public discord among Paul and, like, the Fremen Naibes by exposing specifically the ones who are conspiring against him, and it'll just, if a bunch of them suddenly disappear or get killed or he puts them on trial or something, then that's a very public crack in support for the alleged messiah of the Fremen. Mm-hmm. So perhaps it's just to undermine him that way.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, honestly, there is a specific answer to this, but I can't tell you what it is.
I'm just trying to speculate based on the information that I have currently. Anyway. So Paul now considers this audience over and orders Banerjee to have Cytale Lichna brought to some quarters, but he uses a verbal keyword to indicate that she should be kept under guard. Cytale Lichna hesitates, asking how Paul will find Othium. He tells her to explain the way to Banerjee, but she protests that her father has forbidden her from sharing such information with anyone other than Paul. Banerjee comes up with another solution, apparently knowing someone who can show Paul the way. I don't know why Cytale Lichna can't just tell Paul himself, or how Banerjee knows this guide, or why Paul doesn't already know where Othium lives, but whatever. You'd think he would just kind of know where his various Fedaiken were, right?
Yeah, you'd think, but I mean, he's been emperor, he's been busy, I guess. Not a ton of time to catch up with the boys from back in the day.
I would just think that he would have people keeping tabs on them.
Yeah.
Just seems odd that
I mean,
they
I'm sure,
wouldn't be able to find him. I mean, I guess Arrakis does not have a phone book.
But... True, but I'm sure someone in his empire is sort of keeping tabs on that at a lower level than him, but who knows? Maybe Stilgar knows, you know?
But then why not Stilgar? It's just this whole thing about, like, but how will you find his house? And I'm like, he's in the same city as you. It can't be that hard. So it's like, whole thing, and I don't really understand why. But whatever. So, since he's going to have a guide from Banerjee, Paul states that he will go alone to visit Othium, justifying it to a protesting Banerjee that this is the way Othium wants it, with a heavy dose of irony, because this is obviously all being manipulated by people who are not Othium.
Mm-hmm.
Banerjee isn't happy, but Paul will brook no disagreement here and orders him to just do as he's told. Banerjee isn't on board, but leads Cytale Lichna away instead of arguing further. Alone, Paul feels as if he is just waiting for fate to crash into him. He wonders if he should tell Banerjee that Cytale Lichna is a face dancer, but decides that he cannot, because he did not see himself doing that in the future, and he fears disrupting everything if it doesn't play out correctly and exactly as he saw it. He feels he must find some way to escape this vision path, but is not sure that there will be an opportunity to do so without incurring even greater damage. And there we end that chapter.
Interesting. So, what are your takeaways?
So, what's interesting to me is that it seems like by rights the conspirators should be failing here because they've already lost the element of surprise and Paul knows what's going on, at least to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
At least to a greater degree than I think they thought he would. So, there definitely is some clouding effect from Edric, but he's still able to see enough to figure out the Cytale Lichna thing.
Yep.
Probably helped by the fact that they found this corpse in the desert and were suspicious to begin with, which seems like just a fuck-up on the conspirators' part.
Mm-hmm.
But despite the fact that Paul has figured out at least some of this, he's still just going along the path as if he doesn't have that information because he feels that he has to. It's sort of like a predestination thing where he knows what's going to happen but feels he can't change it because things will be worse if he does.
Mm-hmm.
So he might walk into their trap anyway, even though they kind of fucked up and failed at concealing it from him. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I like how in this book, and I said this before, but I like how it's kind of mysterious as to what will happen. Because in the last book, it wasn't like that. You kind of knew how things were going to play out, but here, there's, like, a bunch of questions and no answers. So you just really have to see how it's going to play out.
Yeah, there's a lot of hints that something bad is going to happen to Paul, which is why I think that he's maybe not going to be in charge by the end of the book. So you have the implications from the beginning with Bronzo's stuff about some sort of falling of Paul.
Yeah, but it's not like...
And then this epigraph from this chapter also seems to indicate that Paul deliberately chose paths that were bad for him, so that indicates that something bad is going to happen to him that we maybe haven't seen yet. But it's not explicit, and you don't know exactly what's going to happen. Whereas in the first book, from Irulan's stuff, you generally knew that Paul was going to be, you know, once we know that he's Muad'Dib, then this Muad'Dib is this important figure who, like, tons of books were written about and has a lot of power and all of this stuff. So you generally knew that Paul was going to end up in a very powerful position.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And that's what I was going to say, because Irulan gives you a lot of that information just outright. Even with, like, Leto is going to die, you know that right away. You know that Yue is the traitor. Like, all that information just comes to you pretty easily. And there's things you don't know about, like you thought the Baron might die, right? That wasn't something that Irulan was explicitly talking about. But in this book, it's just so much more vague. It's kind of hard to predict what's going to happen. Aside from, like, what you're saying with Paul, something bad is probably going to happen based on what we know, but what's that going to be?
Our prescience is clouded by the Dune Tarot.
I suppose it is. Okay, ready to move on to our next chapter? Okay, so the epigraph from chapter 16 is from the Tlilaxu God Book. No matter how exotic human civilization becomes, no matter the developments of life and society, nor the complexity of the machine-human interface, there always come interludes of lonely power when the course of humankind, the very future of humankind, depends upon the relatively simple actions of single individuals.
So I just wanted to point out that God Book is spelled with a U, strangely, it which is. I hated a lot.
Yeah.
God Book. Not really relevant, but just weird, and I didn't like it.
Yeah, and doesn't exactly come across from me reading it out loud, but yes. It is spelled strangely.
Anyway, so this is some sort of philosophical commentary on how history is often shaped by the tides of society and civilization, but you often have points in which single individuals can have an outsized effect. And of course, it seems obvious that one of those individuals is Paul.
Right.
I don't know if you have anything more to add to that, but that was my interpretation.
No, not really. I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward. There's certain times in human history where a person or a group of people had to make a decision that had a huge impact on everyone, basically. And this is just another in that long line.
Okay, so in this chapter, we've jumped forward a little bit from the end of the last one to Paul actually setting off on his journey to meet with Othium, which is obviously a trap of some kind, but he believes that he must walk into it and try to find some way out, because if he evades it entirely, something catastrophic will happen. Although, what is, as usual, unclear. It does seem a little bit like something catastrophic will happen based on the outcomes of Paul's decisions approximately every other Tuesday. So this is nothing new. Paul is disguised as a Fremen, is pretending to limp, and is wearing a shield belt but keeping it inactive so that he will blend in with the crowd. He is also wearing facial prosthetics, and possibly some low-level blackface based on the description. So, I mean, I guess it makes sense from a practical perspective and does not have the same cultural tones that it does in the modern day, but it was definitely a little weird to read, like, oh, face darkening. He appears to be alone to anyone observing, but he has a hidden and disguised security detail all around keeping eyes on him, including some thopters overhead. However, he does find it a bit relaxing to not have all of his guards as close by as usual. He's also wearing a transmitter so that the thopters can track him. Because I assume it would be kind of easy to maybe lose him in the crowd, so the transmitter would let them kind of pick him back up.
Yep, makes sense.
Chaney, apparently, had not approved at all of this little adventure, considering it a waste of time. I think because this can hardly be the only group of people who wants to take down Paul, so why does he have to go personally meet with Othium about it?
Mm-hmm. And go so, like, much out in the open like this.
Yeah. It seems like a great way to get assassinated. Yeah, exactly. Especially because the tarot is clouding things and he can't see the conspirators very clearly, so it does seem pretty dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And given that she is pregnant, I can imagine that she does not want the father of her child potentially murdered in the street.
Yeah, that wouldn't be fun.
Paul reflects on his bitter choices, which he has not explained to her, although she had gotten a glimpse of his agonized desperation just before he left her. However, she mistakes them for normal fears and feelings that someone might have before leaving their partner for a dangerous mission. He wishes that, like her, he did not know about the horrors ahead. Interestingly, in contrast to our earlier discussion about how Paul has failed to install a functioning bureaucracy in favor of his religious corps, Paul, in fact, believes that many new members of the Kizerat are too bureaucratic. They use spice primarily for keeping up the appearances of wealth, and they may pay lip service to the lessons of the Butlerian Jihad, but poorly hide their preferences for the efficiency of machines over men, worshipping routines and records in place of any real gods, although, of course, they have formally converted to the religion of Muad'Dib. So this isn't really super relevant for the rest of what we'll talk about in this episode, but I just thought it was an interesting thought from Paul about how, while to most people it would look like Paul has installed a fanatic religious base full of zealots basically running his empire, he considers that they're not perhaps religious enough and they're too bureaucratic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of perspective, I guess.
Yeah, and it's also highlighting the importance of religion in society, I guess, as well. That I think that has to be a part of their life anyway, even if they're not as interested in it and more interested in other aspects.
Yeah, these people, even if they're not true believers like his original Kizerat were, they have to pretend that they give a shit about it.
Yeah.
In this empire, because it is a theocracy, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, as I said, this doesn't really come back up again, but it was just an interesting observation. So, on the instructions of his Fremen guide, Paul moves with the crowd towards Aaliyah's fane for the evening rite. None of his advisors were thrilled with this plan, but Paul seemed all for it. Amusingly, disguised as a Fremen, the people around him all avoid touching him, and when it becomes too crowded to do that, they obsequiously apologize lest he stab them then and there. Following on from that observation we got from an Aaliyah POV where people who jostle Fremen often end up dead a few blocks away. Paul wonders how he got to this point from his early days on Caladan, and wonders whether he ever really had free choice to end up here, or was just born here by the complexities of fate that led him to feel as if he had to choose the way he did. He still hopes to avert the future he sees farther along his current trajectory, but caught up in the crowd, he feels as if he has lost control. Inside the temple, a choir of acolytes are chanting about Aaliyah's visions. It is all, of course, very complimentary, and Paul thinks that they should be careful of her temper as well as her benevolence. He notices the fake candles all around the room, meant to stir up an ancestral sort of nostalgia, and is somewhat disgusted by his hand in the manipulation. However, looking around at the crowd, he is jealous of the enlightenment that these people seem to find here. Paul tries to move closer to the altar, but is stopped by a hand on his arm. It turns out to be a man called Rasir, whom he remembers from the siege. Paul recognizes that if Rasir had planned an attack, he would be completely vulnerable here in the midst of the crowd before his guards could really circle in.
Mm-hmm.
However, as it turns out, Rasir is in fact his guide, so nothing to worry about there. In the temple, the ritual moves on. An instrument sounds, and the crowd surges forward as a choir of women begins to sing another song about Aaliyah, this time as the protectress of her followers. It makes Paul feel sick to hear this bizarre devotion to his sister. However, he doesn't seem super upset about the fact that they've manipulated the people into worshipping her as a false goddess, but more concerned that she is no longer the child witch that she once was, but is growing older, which, in his mind, is to grow more wicked. So, it seems like he's maybe concerned that as she grows up, she can't be trusted with this power and devotion anymore. It's kind of a weird thought.
Yeah, maybe it's partly because when she was a child, she was like a child oracle, and that was a little bit different from, like, her being a grown adult, because She's also kind of angsty and mean, right? I don't know. I'm trying to piece it together. I'm just thinking maybe her adult persona has a bit of a different appeal than, like, the childish innocence she had before.
Yeah. And she's getting frustrated by her role in all of this. Mm-hmm. But Paul just doesn't elaborate on, like, what he's really concerned about. It's just this growing older means to become more wicked thing, which I just thought was a weird way to think about the problem, maybe. Mm-hmm. As usual, there's not a lot of elaboration on what exactly people mean by their thoughts. Paul thinks about how he is so similar but so different from all the people here, and wonders how he could possibly hope to unite the whole universe under himself when it resists him at every step. Silence falls in the temple as Aaliyah emerges. Paul has never observed one of her rituals from the perspective of the crowd, and he has a sense that where the universe resists him, she is able to just take it in. Aaliyah speaks some ritual words and then drinks from a chalice containing what I think is the water of life. Paul finds himself holding his breath with all of the other pilgrims, having been caught up in the collective tau of their experience, even though he knows what will happen to Aaliyah. He recalls his own experience with this substance, but does not know what it is that Aaliyah is seeing. Aaliyah falls to her knees and Paul exhales, feeling the tau beginning to wear off. He reflects on the nature of visions and how they make you crave absolute answers to the future at the expense of experiencing the present you are still living in. Paul feels as if he's having a transcendental experience, as if this place illuminates everything, even his own hunger for power. Aaliyah begins speaking. She describes the simultaneous darkness and light of time-space, an illuminated abyss full of all the things that have yet to be, including the destinies of the people gathered here today. Paul feels as if he is waiting for some word or signal from her, and feels crushed when she does not speak to him directly. It seems like this is more of the influence of the Tao, as he thinks that the others around him must feel the same way, each having wanted a personal word from their goddess. A woman cries out and Aaliyah looks up, making Paul feel as if he is looking directly into her eyes, although there is no indication that she sees him. The woman begs Aaliyah to tell her whether she will ever see her son again. Apparently, he was killed in the jihad. Aaliyah tells her not to look backwards, and that all things return if you have the sight to recognize their new form. The woman doesn't understand, and Aaliyah quite sharply chastises her, telling her that she is a Fremen, and the Fremen have no use for the dead other than their water. So, that's a harsh thing to say to someone grieving their dead child.
Yeah, a little cold.
Fremen or otherwise. Another man has an even pettier concern for his goddess, asking if he should accept a business proposal. She tells him that he is looking for gold like a beggar, but will only find a dagger, so that's ominous.
Mm. It is.
Perhaps this means that if he accepts the deal, he'll get murdered. The next man, a Fremen, says that he has been asked to kill someone, and he asks whether he should accept, and if he does, what his chances are of succeeding. Aaliyah snaps at him, saying that he had not come here for answers, and is only protesting something he finds hard to believe. Perhaps that he would and could carry out the killing and he just wants an answer rather than having to decide for himself.
Yeah.
Or he wants justification for his decision, maybe. Honestly, I wasn't entirely sure what that meant, but that was my best thought on it.
Yeah, it just seems like he's questioning his own motives here.
And he just wants someone else to take the decision away from him or justify what he's already kind of decided.
Yeah.
A woman nearby, Paul, mutters that Aaliyah is unusually angry today. And Paul thinks that Aaliyah must know that he is in the crowd and or saw something in her vision about him that made her angry. A man in front of Paul calls out to her and asks how long Paul will reign. Aaliyah seems to find the question offensive, sneering an answer about how the man is prejudiced and only has anything at all because of Paul's leadership. She then spins and walks away. Her acolytes start up their chanting again, but were clearly unprepared, the ritual having ended unexpectedly. The crowd is restless. A woman near Paul blames the guy with the business deal for asking a stupid question and pissing off Aaliyah. Which, like, fair.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like that's why she's angry, but that probably didn't help. Paul wonders what Aaliyah had seen that would have put her into such a mood. The ritual had not gone as it usually did from his previous observations, like, from behind the stage. Mm-hmm. Where the pilgrims usually happily ask their silly questions.
Interesting that this all broke down right when she was asked about how long Paul will reign.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it didn't seem like it was going great before that, but that definitely is what triggered her spinning around and leaving. Mm-hmm. Just being like, I'm fucking done with this. I feel like if I was one of the pilgrims, I would feel very cheated for having attended that ritual.
Yeah. Is there an entry fee?
Right.
Because I'd want a refund.
Paul's musings are interrupted by Rasir pulling on his sleeve and nodding towards the exit, where the pilgrims are already heading. They go along with the flow of the crowd, and Paul feels like he no longer has any control and is merely the vehicle of some greater power, allowing himself to be led along by this older Fremen man. The path he's being led along is identical to what he has seen in his visions, leading to some terrible outcome. But, I guess, less terrible than what would happen if he deviated from this path. My assumption is that the terrible path he's on leads to Chaney's death, so he is personally devastated about it and trying to evade it, but the consequences if he diverts from the path are more destructively widespread somehow.
Mm-hmm.
That's my best understanding of why he thinks the current path is terrible, but he can't go off of it because it'd be worse otherwise.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Paul darkly thinks that he knows what Aaliyah saw, as it must be the same thing that he has seen himself, and that she doesn't protest that future because she too knows the consequences if it does not come to pass. So basically, similarly, she sees a dark and terrible future, perhaps being upset and angry because she also cares about Chaney or some other people who might die in this timeline, but knows that averting that future would be worse.
Yep.
It would be cool if the two of them, like, chatted about this at some point.
I know, right? Why can't they, like, put their heads together?
You'd and just, think like, that confirm combined... that they're both seeing the same thing and that there yeah. isn't a way out.
You think that combined prescience would maybe get them a little further.
Yeah. Or at least just confirm that, like, they didn't miss any possible exit ramps, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Any final thoughts about this chapter?
I guess just that it's interesting to see this ritual play out this way with Paul sort of in the crowd viewing it from, like, the average person's standpoint and showing how disconnected he really is from the way his people live their daily lives. Because in the first book, he was pretty closely connected to everyone in the siege, and now he just is a complete stranger if he goes out like this, right? He has to, I mean, I know he's, like, famous, so he can't just, like, walk out there, but he's got to dress up, like, a completely different person and go out into that crowd and basically be a stranger. And it's just kind of an interesting transformation he's undergone since the last book.
Yeah, I think for me what I found really interesting about this chapter is that I think it illuminates part of why Aaliyah is so frustrated with her role in Paul's empire. Because she's basically a curiosity for the pilgrims. Like, every day or every week or however often she does this evening ritual, she drinks the fucking water of life and goes into a trance and they ask her dumb questions about their futures. And she's just, like, an oracle on display.
She's basically an entertainer.
Yeah. And I can see that she would be frustrated that she has to do this very performative role when she didn't really ask for or want any of it.
Mm-hmm.
Even less than Paul did, because she was awoken at birth, or before birth.
Right.
And, like, I don't get the sense that she ever really had the option to do anything else.
No. It seems like she's sort of been shoehorned into this role.
And so she, now that she's older and has had to do this for a long time, you can see it kind of chafing, and that she's just sick of it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you want to move on to the last chapter?
Sure, let's do it. So, chapter 17. Our epigraph is from Order in Council, the Emperor Paul Muad'Dib. Production growth and income growth must not get out of step in my empire. That is the substance of my command. There are to be no balance of payment difficulties between the different spheres of influence, and the reason for this is simply because I command it. I want to emphasize my authority in this area. I am the supreme energy eater of this domain, and will remain so, alive or dead. My government is the economy.
So this is a charming example of Paul's more despotic tendencies,
mm-hmm.
exerting complete control over the economy, not out of any high-minded ideals of benevolently ensuring that all imperial citizens are cared for or have what they need, but instead out of his need or desire to exert complete and total control over all aspects of the empire.
Right.
And while he does say alive or dead, I don't think that putting your entire economy under a cult of personality is a great way to set it up for long-lasting success after you die. Because, like, what if your kids aren't prescient? What if they don't have the same power that you do? I mean, I know he might know that Chaney's baby has prescience because he can see the future or something, but we don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, unless prescience is a dominant genetic trait. It took a really long time to breed someone who had this level of prescience, and Chaney doesn't have any background of that beyond, like, the low-level Fremen abilities. So who the hell knows? And then who knows if the kids' kids and so on would have those powers? It seems like this structure would set up anyone who's not Paul or as powerful as Paul for failure.
Right, which is basically what he wants, right? He's trying to make it impossible for someone else to rise up.
But, I mean, he's potentially making it difficult for his heirs once he's dead. Because his heirs will not be him. So he has to hope or expect that they will develop the same degree of control and cult of personality that he does.
Mm. Yeah, that's a fair point.
But then again, he knows the future, so maybe he knows that that won't be a problem. But since we don't know anything about this baby, other than that, presumably it will be born, given Children of Dune. I don't imagine the Children of Dune are just, like, some random kids.
Just picks up with some random Fremen family.
Yeah, the end of this book, the whole royal family is toast, and we just pick up, so yeah, some, like, random Fremen kids. That'd be interesting. Be a sharp turn. Alright, so we basically pick this chapter up right where the last one left off. So Paul's guide leaves him at the end of a street, directing him towards a specific door and telling him to remember when he was Usul. Paul knows that his security detail will capture the man for questioning, but unexpectedly hopes that he gets away. Doesn't warn him or anything, though, because that would be too nice. Paul recognizes his surroundings as a suburb of Arakeen. Of course, we have seen this place before, as the unfortunate Farrakh and his son lived next door to Othium. Paul observes his surroundings and thinks about how at least some of the Fremen have lost their water discipline living in the city, where they do not have to fight over even the tiniest drops. Paul hesitates but wonders why. He already knew what door to go through even before the man had told him, and he knows that he must play out the events here exactly as they are supposed to happen. He thinks of Caladan with its rain, so different from here, even if he has worked to make this a future reality for Arrakis. He finally goes to Othium's door, where he is greeted by a dwarf, whom you may recall had been mentioned in the discussion between Farrakh and Cytale as a catalyst dwarf. Given this new context, my assumption is that he is meant to be, in some way, a catalyst for Paul's downfall. What is particularly interesting about this man, whose name is Bijaz, is that Paul had never seen him in a vision before, much like our old friend Count Hasimir Fenring.
Mm-hmm.
Paul's vision of these events had not included Bijaz, although so far, all else is the same. Paul knows from past experiences that divergences such as this don't necessarily change the outcomes that he has seen, but it does give him some hope for a different path. He looks up at the moon, wondering desperately how it falls. Back to that again.
Fucking moon.
I do think it's interesting that he saw these events, but completely missing an entire person.
Yeah, and as we will learn, Bijaz is kind of a hard person to miss.
Yeah, seriously. He talks a lot in this chapter. And also, I don't know, like, it just, I guess, you know, Bijaz leads him through the corridors or whatever. So does Paul just think that he's meandering by himself? When he talks to Bijaz, is he, who does he think he's talking to? It's weird how you can have a whole person missing, but everything else still lines up perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, maybe, like, anything that would be related to that person, like conversations with them, things like that, are also things that you wouldn't be able to see in your future sense.
And so they're just, like, blurs in the vision or something?
I guess.
Or gaps in the vision?
Maybe gaps. Like, the vision just kind of, like, shows you. I mean, I guess we're sort of thinking it from the perspective of if you were, like, watching a video recording that had a person in it, and then you couldn't see the person in the recording, you'd have to blur them out, or you'd have to cut them out, or something like that. And maybe for prescience, it isn't like that. Maybe just, like, references to them just aren't apparent.
I guess, but it's, I mean, I can see that for certain things, but later there's, like, you know, a four-way conversation between Paul and Bijaz and Otham and his wife, and just how you would have a vision of that, but missing one whole part of it is just not entirely clear to me. But whatever. That's how it is for Paul, so we'll just accept that, but it's just a little hard to comprehend, I guess. Bijaz ushers him in, addressing him as Sire, which indicates that he knows who Paul is, even with the disguise. Paul is led through the house to a central courtyard before Bijaz vanishes down a side corridor. Paul continues to hope, although he finds the atmosphere here oppressive and wonders whether choosing the lesser evil is defeat. Of course, we don't know what evils he's referring to here, although, as I said, my guess is that it's permitting Chaney to die to prevent some other horror. Paul tries to figure out how Bijaz fits into things and what his absence from the visions means. Paul crosses the courtyard and enters an open door into a small chamber where Otham and his second wife Dori wait. He notes the barrenness of the room, with clear indications of belongings having been sold, making Paul feel guilty. Paul looks at Otham and sees that he looks just as he did in the vision, with a thin neck and a face half destroyed by scars, a drooping eye, and half his teeth replaced with metal. Paul and Otham greet one another, revealing the thin and feeble quality of Othium's voice. Dori steps forward at this moment, and we learn that she looks like an older Lekna because Otham married both her and her sister, making her Lekna's stepmother and aunt. Something odd is that Paul remembers her as a child, but she is described here as having gray hair, but not more than 15 years or so could have passed from when he first met her. Paul tells Otham that he is in his water debt and asks what Otham wants. Otham reveals that during the jihad, he had caught something called the splitting disease, and Dori elaborates that this means he is dying. As she props up the coughing Otham, Paul realizes that she isn't really as old as he'd thought, but she is aged by her bitterness and loss of hope. So these last 15 years have not been kind to her.
Yeah, I guess not.
Because if Paul remembers her as, like, a child in the siege, we could maybe charitably interpret that as, like, a middle teenager, like 15 or 16. Mm-hmm. And only, like, 15 max years have passed, so she can't be more than 30-ish. But she's got gray hair, and he thinks she looks like an old woman, so... The years have not been kind to this couple.
No, especially when you consider that the spices both give you long life, and everybody has spice in their diet.
That's a very good point, actually. She looks that old. Yeah, actually. My God. When Paul offers to summon the best doctors to care for Otham, Dori tells him they've already done that, and there's nothing more to be done. And when she glances at the bare walls, it is clear that this is what they sold all of their belongings to pay for. I guess Paul's empire does not have universal health care.
Yeah, I guess not.
And even for the Fedaiken.
Yeah, and this just goes to show again how disconnected he is. Like, this was one of his siege brothers, and he didn't even know that he was, like, sick and dying, and he probably could have helped him out a lot, but he didn't.
Yeah. And maybe if Paul had kept better contact with Otham and his family, or just his Fedaiken in general, perhaps Lekna would not have fallen prey to the fate that she did. Mm-hmm. It also makes you wonder what happened to Lekna's mother.
Yeah, is she still around, or is she gone?
No, I think she's either in the first chapter or this chapter. It's clear that she's dead, and that's why she's not present. Paul is on edge, as he recognizes small distinctions between his vision and reality, but is also sure that if he tries to change the broad pattern, things will somehow become violent here. He asks again what they wish of him. Dori is clearly not impressed with the Fremen Messiah, asking him bitterly whether Otham could simply have been asking for his friend to be at his side in his time of dying, and Paul doesn't get angry because he feels it is her right to challenge him in this way. Guilty, Paul tells him that he will do whatever he can that they want. Otham coughs again, but then tells Paul that he knows of a Fremen plot against him. He then loses his breath and cannot speak, and Dori wipes the spittle from his mouth, although with apparent disgust at the waste of water. Paul is livid at what has happened to Otham, and feels that his Fedaiken deserved better than to waste away like this. But he cannot change things now, and none of them can divert from the path of his vision, lest they bring on multiplied horrors for all humankind, as he puts it. Paul sees the desperation with which Dori looks at Otham, and resolves never to let Chaney look that way at him. Though I suspect he'll look that way at Chaney by the end of the book, if she dies as we expect. Or as I expect. You know.
I am the Oracle.
The topic is brought around to the message that Saitel Lekna had mentioned. We learn that apparently Bijaz is the message, Othium bought him on some other planet, apparently a human Distrand, created by the Tlilaxu, and whom Othium has imprinted with the names of all the Fremen traitors. Duri makes a comment that sounds as if they expect Paul to continue caring for Leekna in exchange for Bijaz and his information. Paul mourns internally, knowing that their real daughter is dead, but he won't tell them that. Paul wonders why they didn't come to him earlier for help, and Duri explains everything that they have done for Paul. They took this particular house because they knew it was near the meeting place of the traitors, and Othium stayed away from Paul so that the traitors would believe that he too hated Paul. Paul tells them to summon Bijaz and they will all leave together, but Duri tells him he hasn't been listening. They can't leave with him. Everyone around knows how poor they are, and they have told everyone that they are selling Bijaz as a result. So if Paul leaves with just Bijaz, people will assume he is just the buyer, and no one will suspect that Paul knows anything or that Othium has betrayed the traitors. If they all leave together, it will be obvious what has happened, and they'll lose the element of surprise there.
Right.
Which you'd think Paul would have figured out, being, like, a Mentat, but... I think he feels so guilty that he wants to rescue them in some way.
Yeah, I think he's overwhelmed with his guilt, because not only has he completely neglected these people who care so much about him, but now
and have
also...
have clearly made huge sacrifices for him.
Yeah, exactly. And
beyond
on
even
top
what
of
they
that,
know, because they don't know that their daughter is dead.
Yeah, exactly. On top of that, they don't know their daughter is dead, and they're like, oh, well, just keep our daughter safe, and, you know, she's dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Just really sucks.
Yeah, it's honestly kind of wild that Paul wouldn't have instituted some kind of, like, veterans welfare program for his Fennecan at the very least.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the Kizarat has other goals.
I guess, but I don't know.
You'd think he'd have more sway in his empire and be able to control some of this stuff, but...
Yeah, I mean, and there's not that many Fennecan. It seems like it wouldn't be a huge ask to just make sure that they were taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess when the focus is always on the next jihad, that isn't really the... top of the priority list.
Mm-hmm. Paul thinks about this plan, and he notes to himself that his visions have shown him that he would leave this encounter with the list of names, but he had never actually seen how. He recognizes that this indicates that Bijaz is somehow under the protective circle of another prescient. So, again, this gets at the how he doesn't see certain people in visions, even when they're involved, and so... I guess his vision wasn't clear enough to indicate that he would leave with a human Distrand, but he knew that he would leave with the list of names. And so, at this point, he thinks that this is because Bijaz is loyal to or under the influence of another prescient who is hiding him from the visions.
Mm-hmm. Who do you think that might be?
Well, initially I think you're meant to think it's Edric, but then... by the end of this chapter, we learn that Bijaz also seems to have some degree of prescient tendencies, so it could just be himself. Paul has a bit of a mini mental rant about how he has never had free will, the jihad chose him, and he has been forced onto his path by countless forces that direct his decisions. His pendulum of emotion swings back to feeling as if there is really no hope to change things anymore, but somehow this thought in itself swings him back to having hope, so... Very much like the last book, in which every other thought, Paul is, I can save everyone from the jihad, to the jihad is coming and nothing can stop it. Paul orders Bijaz to be summoned. Duri tells Bijaz that Usul is his new master. Bijaz instantly jumps into some wordplay about the meaning of Usul, and we learn that this is apparently how he usually speaks, and Duri apologizes. Paul notes the spice blue eyes of the diminutive man and considers that he is an educated and observant creation of the Bene Tlilax, far too valuable to have been simply tossed aside as Othium thought. He asks Bijaz what talents he has. Unsurprisingly, given the way he tends to speak, he doesn't answer directly, but does say that he is a rare skill for knowing when to leave, and would you look at that, now would be a great time to do so. Paul, of course, hasn't seen this specific interaction, but the timing seems to fit his vision. Paul then asks how Bijaz knew to call him sire earlier, and Bijaz starts rattling on about fingers and patrons and stuff like that, although he confirms that he does know Paul is the emperor. I found this very difficult to summarize because it doesn't really make sense unless you transcribe the whole thing, and I didn't want to do that for every one of the things that he says, but it's just a bunch of, like, puns and wordplay.
Yeah, especially
such.
The thing about the finger was really weird.
Yeah, I don't know.
He said something like, oh, you're a finger, and look, this is my finger. See, it is a finger. It was such a weird thing for him to say.
Bijaz seems to be a little bit sad to be leaving Othium and Dory, but he does get over it pretty quickly. He asks Paul whether he will be kind, reminding his new patron that he is a person rather than a thing, even if he was bought, and describes himself in a series of riddle-like expressions. Dory seems apologetic for his loquacity and says that they really should get going, and Bijaz agrees, suggesting that he also has truth sense, although this isn't confirmed. Paul hesitates to leave, wishing to allow the full vision to play out, as apparently he's not supposed to actually leave quite yet. He fears the consequences if he changes anything, even this. It seems that there are still things that Othium must say before the vision ended. Bijaz says that he has now sense and appears nervous, and Paul wonders whether Bijaz himself is the prescient concealing himself from the vision. Othium suddenly pipes up again, asking about Lychna, and Dory tells him that she is safe. Paul looks down so they can't see the expression on his face. However, Othium believes that this means he is nodding in agreement and continues. He tells Paul that he doesn't like the new world they've created after the jihad, and thinks that they were better off when they lived in the desert and just had to worry about the Harkonnens. Which I can't say I necessarily disagree with.
Yeah, seems like better times.
In some respects, at least, yeah. Bijaz again encourages Paul to leave, but Paul still doesn't think he can, so he asks what now sense means. And an agitated Bijaz just tugs on his robe and says, now, we must leave now. In contrast to his obvious agitation, Othium just gives him an affectionate look and says that he means no harm. So it does seem, at least, that Bijaz was probably treated reasonably well by Othium and Dory. Paul asks Bijaz what he is afraid of. Bijaz describes a spirit that seeks him, that does not think and takes over his body, and that he fears both what he sees and what he does not see. It's not entirely clear what all of this means, but Paul interprets this as meaning that he does indeed have some prescience, although he's not sure if it is the small prescience of the tarot users or something more powerful, like his own abilities. And he wonders what Bijaz has seen. Dory and Bijaz again encourage Paul to leave, but the moment still isn't right. Paul also feels that hesitating delays his guilt. He addresses Othium's statement about the world, saying that they live in troubled times. Othium nods, and Dory comments that the Fremen know how to deal with trouble. Paul is shaken by Othium's bitterness and Dory's clear resentment of him, wondering whether anything is worth this cost. Finally, Othium wheezes out a "Do what you must, Usul," freeing Paul to leave under the terms of the vision. He completes the encounter by saying, "There'll be an accounting," and then leaves with Bijaz following behind. Bijaz ominously comments that today has been a dirty day. And there we end the chapter. And this episode.
Yeah. So final thoughts on the chapter?
I guess I just feel bad for Othium and Dory, because it seems like they, despite Paul's abandonment of them, have been working for him this whole time, mm-hmm. and just making a lot of sacrifices for him, and they're being repaid with a dead daughter, a dying Othium, and Dory soon to be left all alone, I guess, having sold most of their possessions for treatment that won't even work in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't leave anyone in a good position.
No.
And it really does make me wonder what Bijaz's role is meant to be, like what is his role as a catalyst.
Yeah, so there's like a couple things going on in this chapter. You have the whole interaction between Paul and Othium's family, which is really interesting because you get to really see the impact of everything that's happened under Paul's empire, sort of personified in Othium and his wife.
Mm-hmm. Paul hasn't even been able to protect people who are theoretically supposed to be his friends, let alone people in other worlds that he has no personal connection to.
Yeah, so I guess at the end of the day, what was the point? Like, why did all of this have to happen? Because
we still don't know what the alternative was.
Yeah, and the people don't seem to be better off. So no. I think it casts a lot of doubt on Paul. And then on the other hand, we have this Tom Bombadil motherfucker who shows up talking about fingers and, like, completely, like, throws a wrench in that theme.
Yeah, it does make you wonder why he speaks the way he does. I guess it's some Tylaxu conditioning thing, but
yeah.
perhaps when I was saying that the little rhyming thing of the Tleilaxu seemed out of character, I guess I was wrong because it seems whimsy is part of their shtick.
I guess so.
Yeah. I found it really amusing to read. It was just, like, hard to communicate in notes exactly how it comes across. But yeah, I like your Tom Pompadour comparison. At least he's not singing.
True. Yet.
but yeah, it is interesting because he clearly feels as if something bad is going to go down if they don't leave right now. So that also kind of doesn't bode well for Othium and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's going to happen if they stay there? Is there going to be an assassination attempt?
Could be.
Because people know that they're in Othium's house? Like, the conspirators know that they're there, so are they going to try and take out Paul there? And so Bijaz is like, we gotta fucking go.
Hey, that could be it.
I don't know. I'm pretty interested to see how he plays into things and what the conspirators expect his role to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what other rhymes we may get from him.
Yes.
All right, do you have any other thoughts before we wrap up?
I don't think so. I'm really enjoying that the plot is really progressing now. Like, these last three chapters have just been, like, stuff. I mean, I guess the middle chapter is kind of weird because it's just, like, a weird interlude in Paul going to Othium's house.
Mm-hmm.
But at least the first and third chapter had a lot of, like, plot progression.
Yeah, I think the second chapter was worth it just to see that whole Paul and Aaliyah thing, right? And sort of the contrast between where Paul usually sits and where he was sitting there in the crowd, so that was kind of an interesting take. But yeah, definitely some good plot progression. This book moves along a lot faster than the first book did.
Yeah, so. It certainly does. I mean, we only have three more episodes of plot to go after this one.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy. I mean, it's about half the length in terms of episodes anyway as the last book.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll be on to children.
Yep. Exciting stuff.
All right, so shall we wrap up for the day?
Sure. Till next time, I'm Alex.
I'm Elaine.
Thanks for listening. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Pod Emperor of Dune. If you enjoyed listening to us, we'd appreciate a review on your podcasting host of choice, and be sure to let your friends know about us. You can find us on Twitter under the handle NerdIsayMore, or send us an email at nerdisaymore@gmail.com. If you'd like to support us further, please go to patreon.com/nerdisaymore, where you can also get access to exclusive content.